Every day, there are families who struggle to make ends meet. On paper, many do earn enough to pay their bills, but they fall behind because of timing, like when the rent is due on the 10th and payday isn't until the 15th. There's a research project called U.S. Financial Diaries that's been tracking several hundred of these families. We're going to hear now about one solution that they found people turning to. Marianne McCune of Planet Money and WNYC reports on informal banking.
How informal? Meet Miguel Rada. He just spent 32 years in prison. He lives in a halfway house in West Harlem. He's on public assistance. He's also a banker.
One time, a guy came to me and he said, look, I got to do something over the weekend. I need $20.
People ask him for help a lot because Miguel Rada has a reputation for penny pinching. The man just took a personal finance course at a local credit union called Neighborhood Trust. To manage his money, he says he just asks himself,
what do I need for this week? Do I need car fare? No, my Metro card is still valid. So I'll put 10 away and I keep 20.
So if you need to travel to see your mom and you don't have money to get there, in Miguel Rada's pocket is a tiny bank. He's actually helping people do something economists call consumption smoothing, basically figuring out ways to pay for regular needs, even when income is erratic. A lot of people use credit cards or banks.
The people you're lending to, could they borrow from a credit card or a bank?
Some of their credit is so bad, you know, it would be virtually impossible.
His version of a credit check?
I might ask somebody, what's the problem? Is there a way out?
His ledger.
I keep it up here in my head.
He doesn't charge interest, and if somebody doesn't come back with his money, he says he doesn't bother them. But there are ramifications.
If you don't pay, it won't happen again.
For people who need help saving, here's a more surprising bankish thing Rada does. He accepts deposits, like from his much less frugal brother.
I say, yo, you want me to hold something for you? Yeah, man, hold this 100 for me.
The last time his brother came back for it,
I asked him, what's going on? You know, what do you need this for? And he told me, I got to take care of this bill. I got to do this. So, and I went with him.
And that is the kind of scenario that would make Tamara Bullock feel ill. She never borrows from family.
Because when you put family and then they have the right to critique.
Bullock is in her tiny office at a Harlem funeral home. She's a single mom climbing her way out of a decade of debt. She has a different informal saving strategy. It's called a SUSU, a savings group. And the last one she was part of is pretty typical. 13 colleagues and friends promised to pitch in $100 every 2 weeks for a total of $1,300 each time. Every 2 weeks, somebody in the group gets the pot. Bullock says she loves SUSUs because they force you to save.
You have to. Like, there's no ifs, ands, or buts because other people are dependent on you to be accountable.
2 weeks ago, when her turn came to get the $1,300, she used it to pay a lump sum to a collection agency, which actually saved her money in the long run. She does have a savings account, too. But the SUSU, as someone who loves shopping a little too much,
I like that I can't access it.
As for what to do with her next payout, in the office next door, 62-year-old Patricia Hamilton says she wants to repeat an adventure they had together a while back.
She's going to skydive again. We're going to go swimming with the sharks also. She's going to skydive again.
Informal lending can be a great tool. But Rachel Schneider with the Center for Financial Services Innovation, that's one of the groups behind the Financial Diaries project, she says there are some downsides.
A key issue is that with that form of lending, you don't necessarily build up a credit history. And yet the repayment behavior is just as good as if you had a credit card and your payments got reported to the credit bureau.
Schneider's group and others are taking note. At least one bank is trying to make people's unofficial good credit with friends and family count on their official credit history. And there's a lot of unofficial good credit out there. Remember that friend of Miguel Rada's, the guy who borrowed $20 for the weekend? He just needed to get to a job where he got paid.
Monday morning, he came to me and he says, here, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I needed it. I said, no problem, man.
Come back again. Marianne McCune, NPR News, New York.
We are broadcasting today from the Pacific Science Center in Seattle, and just steps away from this building, right outside, is something that should be familiar to anyone who's ever received a postcard from Seattle or taken home a pen or glass or anything, a tchotchke of any kind, and it's a Space Needle. Built in connection with the 1962 World's Fair, it is an iconic part of the Seattle skyline. And joining me now to talk about the history of the Space Needle and its engineering, its design, is Newt Berger. He's author of the book Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. He's an editor-at-large for Seattle Magazine and regular contributor to KUOW in Seattle. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
I'm probably the old enough to remember when that was built in 1962.
It was highly publicized. Its image got all over the world.
And how it has a unique design to it. Who designed it, and why does it have the shape it has?
Well, that's a really interesting question. It's actually a complicated story. The chief architect was a man named John Graham Jr. Had a large architectural firm. He was mainly known as the man who invented the first really successful shopping mall, which was here in Seattle, Northgate. He had the task of creating the Space Needle, but they got stuck on the design. They had a doodle on a napkin. He had a bunch of architects who began looking at a tower-like structure. They were inspired by a broadcast tower in Germany in Stuttgart, which had a restaurant on it. And so they knew they wanted an observation deck, but they were kind of open to what else they would do. They thought about putting a planetarium up there and a helicopter pad.
No kidding.
Yeah, they considered all kinds of things. But they were stuck on coming up with a design that was really a wow design. So John Graham hired as a consultant a professor from the University of Washington named Victor Steinbrück. He's known locally in Seattle as an architect activist who saved the Pike Place market. But he was a designer, and he worked on the Space Needle design. He got stuck, and one day he was sitting in his home office, and he saw that he had a beautiful abstract sculpture by a California artist named David Lemon, and it was a feminine figure in complete abstract, reaching up to the sky with this narrow waist and then this tripod legs. Mm-hmm. And it was called the Feminine One, and he went, aha, okay, there is a unique shape for a tower.
Wow. If you have a question you want to ask Knut, get up there on our microphones and you can ask it. Were there any engineering innovations that were required to get this to be built? Anything about the revolving restaurant, anything like that?
Well, it was interesting because at that time there were no revolving restaurants.
Oh, well, then there had to be.
There had to be an innovation. Yeah, yeah. John Graham was actually building a revolving bar in Honolulu. And they thought, well, Graham wanted a flying saucer shape. And of course, Washington State had kicked off the whole flying saucer craze with a sighting at Mount Rainier in 1947 that the press had called flying saucer. But it became this kind of iconic idea of what the future would look like. Well, because it was the circular shape, a revolving restaurant made sense. Graham patented a gearing system that allowed you to turn the entire restaurant of 250 people with a one-horsepower motor.
Wow.
And that was built up in Everett, Washington, just north of Seattle.
So the size that drives a washing machine. So
yeah.
Very small.
Exactly.
Very small.
Exactly.
Motor.
They have the motor in there now is a little bigger, but it only takes one horsepower to turn it.
Wow. We actually, on our website at sciencefriday.com/space needle, we have some photos of it under construction if you want to go over there and look at that. I understand there was something also innovative about having to design the telephone system that worked up there.
Yeah, they wanted to be able to have telephones on the tables in the rotating restaurant.
Like they do in big city
exactly.
restaurants, have
just
a phone at your table.
Precisely, yeah. and except they couldn't plug the phones in, so they needed wireless phones.
They couldn't plug them in because it's rotating.
That's right.
I see.
Yeah, and it goes around about once an hour, so... What they did was they went to Pacific Northwest Bell and had the engineers there create a wireless telephone. So the Space Needle actually had wireless phones. In 1962, you could sit down, you could make a call. There was a radio pickup in the wall, and they would connect you then to the operator so you could call out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I took a visit to the Space Needle yesterday, and I'm being a geek myself. I was really enthralled with the technology and just the pure nuts and bolts that are holding it together. I remember walking out and seeing this giant nut and screw and nut holding it bolted. It's bolted to the ground.
Yeah.
Of course, being a geek, I wanted to know the size of the wrench it took to do that. But that seemed to be very, very simple, and it seems to be holding up very, very well.
Yeah, they hired an engineer from Southern California, a guy named John Manassian. And Manassian was an expert in towers, and he built rocket gantries for Cape Canaveral for the Saturn rockets. He also built missile testing gantries for the Air Force at Edwards Air Force Base and broadcast towers. And he contributed pretty significantly to the needle design in terms of, for one thing, being from Southern California. He'd studied with Richter at Caltech.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "We're gonna put in a foundation that will stand the test of time."
Mm-hmm. And it has been. And you know, you were in a very tectonic part of the world. There are a lot of earthquakes that happen here. I imagine that was taken into account when the design.
Yeah, they did wind tunnel tests at the University of Washington, and they basically doubled the load so that it was twice the required code at the time. I've talked to an engineer who worked on the project, says it'll stay standing with a nine point quake.
Wow. Wow, and was it designed with the Cold War in mind? We were right in the middle of coldest part of the Cold War at that time.
The whole World's Fair was part of the national response to Sputnik. It received federal funding because the scientists in the U.S. wanted a science fair, and the Eisenhower administration thought that was a good idea.
There had just been one in Belgium, right, a few years beforehand.
That's right, 1958.
And it had a big, if I remember correctly, had like a big atom as its symbol. And so the scientists wanted something to compete with that.
That's right. And the U.S. scientists had been very disappointed in the 58 Brussels Fair because they felt the Russians had outshone us in terms of science. And they said, we need to do something. And the Seattle guys came along and said, we want to do a fair. You want a science fair. That's what this will be about. The Space Needle was designed to be a symbol of the kind of uplift that science and technology represented to the world. When they broke ground on the Space Needle, it was literally the same time that the Berlin Wall was being built. And it became this kind of symbol about the difference between us and the Soviets. They were putting up barbed wire. We were putting up a vista to the world.
Talking with Knut Berger on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatto here at in Seattle at the Pacific Science Center, right next to the Space Needle. If it were to be built today, would anything be built differently about it, structurally or design-wise, or is it almost a perfect needle?
You know, I asked the engineer who's still alive who worked on it, I asked him that exact question. I said, what would you do today? And he said, basically, we wouldn't do anything different. He said we could take some of the weight out of it. They overbuilt it.
It's solid.
It's very solid. Although it's one of the first questions people ask when they see it is it going to fall over?
Is that right?
Yeah, people think. I think it's because of the wasp waste and then the way it flares out with this platform on top. People have the sense that it's delicate, which is a great design element.
Were things added during the years, or is it the same thing that we've...
Things have been added during the years. There's what's called the skyline level, which is a public event space built at the 100-foot level. They've also built a building kind of around the base that has the gift shop. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's pretty much intact.
Mm-hmm. And it was built with the science fair in mind as part of a larger ground. Part of it, it would fit into the larger works of the whole World's Fair here.
That's right. It was actually late coming in the fair. They realized in the process they needed a symbol for the fair, and they didn't have one. They didn't have a means of financing it. They didn't have a location for it. Space Needle is where it is because the city managed to find a small piece of property that they could sell to a private developer to build the Space Needle, and it happened to be the perfect spot.
You talked about the structure itself having a very feminine shape to it, but anybody who has looked at this thing swears that it looks like a UFO at the top there, landing or taking off.
Well,
was that done on purpose?
Yes, it was. In fact, John Graham, when the guys would come to him with designs, one of the things he constantly was exhorting them is he'd say about the top, he'd say, more disky, more disky. It needs to be more disky. He really wanted that flying saucer shape. And if you look at some of the rejected designs, you'll see that some look like bagels and some look like, Buck Rogers things. I mean, it just,
So why did he want it? Was it just the era that was happening in? I remember the 50s were filled with sightings of flying saucers and things like that.
It was the fair was the space age. So we were going into space. Who had the best technology in space? It was the aliens who were visiting the Earth. It was the UFO. It represented these advanced civilizations that were doing what we aspired to. So it just became a kind of symbol for that. But it also had that connection with Mount Rainier. And one of the great views of the Space Needle is on a day when the clouds are there, and you can see it literally just kind of hovering above the clouds, and you can't see the base.
That's
like a... one of those fabulous views.
It was a fabulous view yesterday, and I appreciate it. And it took me that many years to get up there and see it, and I'm glad I did. Thank you very much, Knut,
for
joining us today. Knut Berger, he's author of the book Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. He's an editor-at-large for Seattle Magazine and regular contributor to KUOW right here in Seattle. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our correspondent and managing editor for video. Our associate senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Eli Chen, our assistant producer. Leo De Aguila is our audio engineer. Neil Rauch is our technical director and spinning the dials here in Seattle. We also had a lot of help today. We have Tinbeat Emyas. Ermiasa and engineers Melissa Marquis and Michael Cullen in Washington. Thanks also to Jen Benz, Jenny Cornish, Tom Wall, Alex Hinkle, Crystal Clarity, and all the folks at the Pacific Science Center. You were very, very helpful for us today. And if you missed any part of our program and you want to hear it again, you want to hear about the Space Needle, I'm going to tell your friends to listen in to what they've missed today. You can go over to our website at sciencefriday.com, or you can download our apps on iTunes and Android, or listen on our website any time of the week. And you can join us. You can join our community, our social community on Facebook. We're there all week. And we Twitter at SciFry, and we're very happy to talk to you all weekend long. I'm Ira Flato in Seattle.
An American institution is going through a difficult time. The Grange is a fraternal organization started after the Civil War for rural families, mostly farmers. These days, its membership has been declining, and Grange halls have been closing. But a new generation of farmers has started joining, a generation interested in organic agriculture and environmental issues. As NPR's Jeff Brady reports, their politics and activism are causing some friction.
The Grange has been around for nearly 150 years, and it played a significant role in some big issues, like successfully lobbying to regulate monopolies. It supported women's suffrage, and it still pushes Congress to improve rural infrastructure. For many, the local Grange Hall was the place to be when they were growing up.
If you wanted to go to a dance, you went to the Grange Hall.
Ed Luttrell is the national president of the Grange.
There wasn't dancing anywhere else in town. So if you wanted to go where the pretty girls were or the handsome young men, you went down to the Grange and you participated.
In the 1870s, Grange membership was estimated at as high as 2 million. Today, it's less than a tenth of that. Still, there are more than 2,000 Grange halls left, and many of them still host monthly potluck dinners. We're at the Mary's River Grange, almost 100 miles south of Portland, Oregon. A few people are setting the table. Across the hall, there's a stage. Above, huge timber beams, and underfoot, a newly refinished wood floor. Jay Sexton holds the post of lecturer here and says in 2009, this local institution almost shut down.
It had been voted by the few remaining older members to close this Grange.
But word spread. New people showed up, and many of them came with new ideas.
Thinking about having the Grange be an advocate for local farms, healthy, clean food, contact between producers and consumers in farmers' markets.
Now, this Grange invites young farmers to talk about things such as raising hogs humanely and naturally. And as members load up plates of food, they exchange tips about organic gardening.
What about letting the strawberries produce the first season of grain in the ground. Is that a good idea?
I think it's okay.
Yeah.
What happened at Mary's River Grange is also happening in other communities. A few granges in Oregon have joined a loose coalition dubbed Green Granges. They work together to advance the goals some of these new Grange members feel passionately about. That's fine, says National President Luttrell, but the Grange has a history of supporting all forms of agriculture, including industrial farms.
We do have some of our green granges that want to be exclusive, not inclusive. Basically, it's my way or the highway. And in those cases, I really feel strongly that those members need to understand our history and understand where we came from.
In California, something similar to the Green Grange movement is happening. State Grange Master Bob McFarland spoke at a rally last summer supporting a measure to label food with genetically modified ingredients.
The consumers of California have a right to know what they put in their bodies, where it comes from, and how it is produced.
Voters rejected the measure, but this advocacy caused friction with the National Grange. A legal battle has since flared up, with national leaders accusing the California Grange of going its own way and violating Grange rules. In April, California was stripped of its charter. Gus Frederick is with the Green Granges in Oregon and says he understands why older Grange members are upset by this new generation.
Change is scary, you know, and they see, you know, what they may identify as hippies, quote-unquote, coming in and all of a sudden becoming involved in something that traditionally they hadn't been involved before. They may, oh my God, we're being taken over.
But Frederick says that's not the case. Many of the new Grangers are inspired by the founding principles of the Grange. They enjoy repeating the stories of Grangers in history standing up to railroad monopolies. That history is one of the things that attracted probably the most famous Grange member today. Chris Novoselic co-founded the grunge rock band Nirvana.
So I went from grunge to Grange.
Novoselic is the master at his local Grange in southwest Washington State.
I have an issue with, like, the label a green grange, okay, because we should just all be Grangers, okay? Our grange is a grange. It's not a green grange. It's not a liberal grange. It's not a conservative grange. It's just a grange.
Grange leaders are frustrated with this internal conflict. They'd rather focus on attracting new members. Susan Noah is master of the Oregon State Grange.
In the Grange, we refer to ourselves as family. We call each other brothers and sisters. And so as a brother and sister, you may fight, you may argue, but at the end of the day, you still remain friends and family.
But first, this family will have to work out its differences and decide what direction the Grange is headed. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
And on that note, we turn to our regular Friday political commentators, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times. Welcome back to you both.
Good to be with you.
So Ben Rhodes there at the White House speaking about humble aspirations in Syria. But we also heard very heated language today from Senator John McCain. He's been pushing for a much more aggressive stance in Syria. He told Fox News, it's disgraceful, the conduct of the United States sitting by and watching this happen. David, let's start with you. Are we seeing an overly cautious or a wisely cautious Obama administration?
I would go with overly cautious. Listen, we've got a humanitarian disaster. As Bill Clinton said, tens of thousands of people have died in the last 25 months. You want to be caught trying to do something, not trying not to do something. Second, the strategic architecture of the region is falling. Third, the president had said Assad has to go, and now the course of the war suggests Assad is going to stay and win. And then finally, we've got Hezbollah tied down fighting the rebels, and surely we want the Hezbollah tied down as much as possible. So to me, there are four good reasons to do something. It's not disgraceful. It's a good step forward for the administration. I wish I knew what the strategy was. Giving them some small arms fire and some bullets and things like that strikes me as pretty de minimis, and I'm not sure what exactly we're getting out of this.
EJ, do you see a strategy that makes sense to you?
I don't think they have a strategy yet, because I think they and a lot of people, including a lot of people in the CIA, were surprised at the turn the war took. I don't think a lot of people anticipated that Iran and Hezbollah would get involved to the degree they did. And I don't think a lot of people anticipated that Assad would be in the kind of shape he is in now. People thought he might fall earlier, certainly not be on the offensive as he is now. But I am not of the view that he was overly cautious. I was struck by something that Professor Mark Lynch wrote in Foreign Policy Magazine's website today. He said the first step on a slippery slope is always easy, but it's much harder to actually resolve a conflict or to find a way out of a quagmire. And I think the real problem here is there are two parallel arguments. Are we doing this for humanitarian purposes that dictates one policy, or are we really worried about the spread of Iranian influence that dictates another policy? And so I think we are trying to figure out where we go from here, given some circumstances that we didn't anticipate, unfortunate circumstances, if you would prefer, as I would, to see Assad out of power.
Let's move on to the revelations about NSA surveillance and the amassing of phone records. There is a bill in Congress, David, that would declassify significant opinions by the FISA court that authorized the surveillance in the first place. Good idea?
I don't think so. You know, I basically support the policy. I worry about its abuse in the future, but nobody, not even Snowden, could point to abuse in the present.
You're talking about the leaker, Edward Snowden.
Right, Edward Snowden could point to abuse in the present. I think the data sweeping exercises that they do are less intrusive, frankly, than anything that happens at the TSA. It would certainly be less intrusive than getting rid of those data sweeping and forcing them to go back to the eavesdropping they would want to do otherwise. So, you know, I think the system, until we can prove otherwise, is basically working. And I've actually been pleasantly surprised, I guess, by how much the American people agree with me. The NSA has not produced a popular outlast. On the contrary, nearly two-thirds of the American people, according to the recent polls, support the policy.
EJ, what do you think of those
polls? Well, I actually wrote in support of that proposal, which has been put out there by Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon and a group of seven other senators, including two Republicans. I don't see anything wrong with saying, as a country, if we're going to debate this, let's find out what the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court has decided. What is the basis for this debate? I think that this is not an all or nothing thing. We do want to be protected. I was not surprised, honestly, that the government collects an awful lot of information. But I think it's perfectly reasonable to say we want some protections around this. We want some privacy protections. And we also, by the way, need to acknowledge, as David's colleague Ross Douthat noted, that we're also worried about privacy from private collectors of information. But I think we should take some steps to make sure that we're not violating rights here.
On the question of intrusiveness that David raised, I want to play some tape of then-Senator Joe Biden back in 2006. This was a point when the Bush administration was found to have collected millions of phone records without a warrant.
I don't have to listen to your phone calls to know what you're doing. If I know every single phone call you made, I'm able to determine every single person you talk to. I can get a pattern about your life that is very, very intrusive.
Well, the distinction now apparently is that the Obama administration did have authorization from the FISA court. But David, is there hypocrisy here? Are the same Democrats who decried such surveillance under the Bush administration very supportive of it now?
I'd say there's education, not hypocrisy.
Evolution.
You know, you get into office and you learn the threats. You get the daily intelligence brief. Maybe you get sucked in by the national security apparatus, but I'd like to say you just learn. And so you do things you wouldn't otherwise do because you learn the truth. As for the point he made, Charles Krauthammer in a column today said it's like the outside of an envelope. The government has a right to keep track of what's on the outside of their envelope. They do not have to read what's in the envelope, and that's essentially what they're doing with the calls. I'm old enough I can remember getting a phone bill where every single call you made was listed on your phone bill. Is that keeping track? Is that an invasion of privacy? I think a minimal one.
Sounds like the distinction that the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, was drawing when he said, well, it's not really collecting it if you're just putting it in a list. It's a collecting it if you take something off the shelf and you read it. EJ, your thoughts?
Well, you know, in only partial defense of Biden, I would say that we have more legal limits now than we did at the time he spoke. But I think there's been a lot of hypocrisy on this. And oddly enough, I kind of welcome it. On the one hand, you do have some liberals who were critical of Bush and now support Obama. And you have a lot of conservatives who supported Bush but now suddenly say the same things are bad. But you also have consistency. You have liberals who are mad at Bush, mad at Obama, liberal conservatives who support Bush, support Obama. I think the fact that there is people have switched sides reflects a deep and intelligent ambivalence. We want to be safe. We also want to be free. And we want to have our privacy protected. And we know it's complicated to have all of those at the same time. And I think the fact that the partisan and ideological lines have been scrambled might actually help us have a debate on the merits.
Okay. Have a great weekend, both of you.
And you too.
E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and Brookings Institution and David Brooks of The New York Times.
Now to last night's spectacular performance in San Antonio.
Green, bad pass, stolen by Wade. Oh, gets in and throws it down. He avoided two Spurs after the steal. What a performance from Dwayne Wade.
Of course, we're talking about basketball, the NBA Finals, and it is suddenly anybody's series. The big three, LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh, led the Miami Heat to a 109-93 victory over the San Antonio Spurs. That evens things at two games apiece heading into Game 5 on Sunday. And sports writer Stefan Fatsis joins us now, as he does most Fridays. Hey there, Stefan.
Hey, Audie.
So what made the Heat so great last night, especially after everyone was moaning about how bad they were a couple days earlier?
Well, the Heat are 6-0 in the playoffs after a loss, and I don't always buy the back-to-the-wall, step-up-your-game, desperation storylines, but it sure looked like the Heat, particularly LeBron James, acknowledged the pressure and responded. And after being under or even unproductive for much of the series, and in the cases of Wade and Bosh, much of the playoffs, the Big Three combined for 85 points and 30 rebounds.
And this has been such a roller coaster. I mean, every game it seems the loser can't possibly stand a chance going forward.
Yeah, the Spurs and the Heat have alternated wins. The last three of them have been blowouts. And after each game, the collective wisdom has been that the loser stars are too old, the Spurs' Tim Duncan and Manu Ginobili, or they're too hurt, Dwayne Wade and the Spurs' Tony Parker. The reality is that these are two great teams. Great teams find ways to adjust and readjust, and that, plus the vagaries of injury and psychology and the bounce of the ball, affect the outcome of games, I wouldn't hazard a guess, for the rest of the series.
And you mentioned injury, which makes me think of Dwayne Wade. Talk a little bit about him.
Well, Wade suffered a deep bone bruise on his right knee in March. Rest is the only sure treatment, but that hasn't been an option. So Wade has played 35 minutes a game in the playoffs with predictable results. Before last night, he was averaging just 13.6 points per game. His kneecap has been shifted and wrapped. He's used hot packs on it during games. According to a story by S.L. Price in this week's Sports Illustrated, Wade also has had his mother, who is a recovered drug addict and a minister, place her hands on his knee and pray. "You're fixing to have a supernatural healing on that knee," she told him. It sure looked like it happened last night.
All right. Well, on a less serious note, there were a couple of suspected cases of flopping in the game. So let's talk about flopping, because the commentators always joke about it, but it's become a serious issue in the NBA.
Yeah, flopping is when a player exaggerates contact in an effort to draw a foul call from the referee. The NBA this past season imposed penalties for flopping, a warning for a first offense, followed by a $5,000 fine. One of the most passionate anti-floppers has been former coach Jeff Van Gundy, who's an analyst for ESPN and ABC. Here he is last night reacting to a dive by Chris Bosh after Bosh was nudged by Tim Duncan.
Well, that's a tough angle. I can't really see what they're calling on Duncan. That, to me, is just a post-up and a flop. Chris Bosh, write your check to the NBA league office. $5,000 for that flop.
The NBA Commissioner David Stern dropped the first offense warning for the playoffs and moved right to the fine. Last week, Stern endorsed ratcheting up the penalties. He said that $5,000 is pocket change to these guys and they have to make it tougher. And Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban gave $100,000 to biomechanics experts at Southern Methodist University to study flopping. In scientific terms, how much force is needed to cause a legitimate loss of balance? The researchers think that the results could enhance video review of suspected flops. I think this is the perfect intersection of science and sports.
It is. I expect you to report back with that flop research, Stefan.
I will.
Stefan Fatsis joins us most Fridays to talk about sports and the business of sports. You can also hear him on Slate Magazine's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen. We'll be right back.